everyone, I'm Colin Ellis, best-selling author, award-winning public speaker, and facilitator of global workplace culture change. And in this, the Culture Makers podcast, I get people managers from around the world to share actionable things that you can do too to create a great place to work. I hope you enjoy the show. Hello, everybody, and welcome to another Culture Makers podcast. I'm Colin D. Ellis, your host, and today I'm joined by Matt Harrington. And Matt is currently the Chief Financial Officer for Australian Super here in Melbourne, but he's got a fantastic career history, having worked for organisations such as Royal & Sun Alliance, Capital, ANZ, Tabcorp, IAG, and Arthur Anderson, which I'm definitely going to ask him about. Matt has worked in London, Sydney, he's been over to New York, Melbourne, Copenhagen, and he's got some fascinating insights into working in different social cultures, and he joins me now. Hello, Matt.
Hello, Colin. Thanks.
I feel like there's so much to talk. Let's get the Arthur Anderson thing out of the way first of all, because I think Arthur Anderson was either the first job or one of the first jobs that you had, but you left before it collapsed in on itself, right?
Fortuitous. Good luck with good management, you be the judge. But I left them in 2000. And, you know, if you wind back and you say, you know, how did you end up at Arthur Anderson? It was actually my second job.
Right.
I had started at an organisation called Ferrier Hodgson. And why did I join them? I started there as a summer intern from university, and they asked me to stay on. Ferrier's at the time was the number one insolvency practice in Australia. It was, frankly, the only subject that really engaged me at university and piqued my interest because it had a real legal component to it. And during my time there, I worked on some of Australia's largest insolvencies, including Pyramid Building Society in Royal in Victoria. And the one missing element I had, or two missing elements I felt at the time after a few years there, was I'd never had a shot at going for then a Big Eight, I think, or Big Six, whatever it was.
Mm.
And equally, I had never, I'd never been to Europe at that stage, and all my mates had done their studies and gone off overseas. So I actually set off with two ambitions, with my Irish European passport in hand, off to London in the mid 90s, with an ambition, one, to travel through Europe and the US, and secondly was to try and get a job in a Big Six or Big Four, and I achieved both. And I reflect on that now and think that was, yeah, a big move, but it was great to have those sort of goals and ambitions and be able to realise them. Look, was I lucky? Absolutely. My marks from university would never have got me into Arthur Anderson, which was the number one firm at the time. And, yeah, I was really lucky. But once you get in there, you know, one is, I believe, you create your own luck. And secondly, once I got in there, I demonstrated that I was good enough to be part of it. And interestingly enough, when I was up for manager the fifth year in, everybody's up for manager, and out of a cohort of eight, so I was the only one out of that cohort who had joined, only three of us made it. And that, to me, demonstrated the benchmarking inside Arthur Anderson. And I always say to this day, it was the organisation that changed me as a professional. Now, going back to your original question, leaving, I came back to Australia. There was no job here in Melbourne. And they were mucking me around a bit, and then suddenly said, "We need you in Sydney, and you need to be there in 3 weeks." So there I was in London. I had my wife. She said she cried for 3 weeks when I told her we're going back to Australia. She had a great job with Salomon Smith Barney, as it was at the time. And we went back to Sydney. And after 3 years there, it was, well, we really want to start a family and do all those sort of things. And family was here in Melbourne. And really the only way to get back here, there was no role at the time with Arthur Anderson. And I also had been on secondments with Channel 7 and Woolworths and had more of a taste for the commercial life, and thought my ability to make partner in Australia with the runway was probably a bit too long. And so I thought I'd take the plunge and jump out. And that's where I got into insurance in a company starting with Fortis, one of the Belgian Dutch bank assurer, which ultimately was acquired by CGU and ultimately IAG. So, yeah, it was very lucky that I got out before everything fell over in 2001.
Yeah, I'm not going to, I won't talk too much about Arthur Andersen. For those, for listeners who are interested, just go Google it and probably go to Wikipedia. Arthur Andersen was kind of brought down, I think, by the Enron scandal. But it was an, you know, it was an interesting, for someone like myself, when I was researching Culture Fix as a book, there's a lot of interesting kind of cultural lessons on there, but I'm not going to dwell on this. Only dwell on the positives on this podcast. There's too much other negative stuff. I'll let other podcasts deal with that stuff. But one of the things that you said, Matt, there, which I'm really going to pick up on, is Arthur Andersen changed you? And I, you know, this is something that I've talked about in the past, you know, particularly when it comes to purpose, and people seem to think that their purpose is in a bedroom drawer, or, and they'll find it one day, oh, it's my purpose. I didn't know I'd put it here. But really, you took a risk in leaving Australia, and you kind of made all of that happen. And you, I completely agree when you said you made your own luck. But I think you have to have you have to be open, and this sense of growth mindset. You have to be open to new ideas, new ways of thinking, and for something to change us as individuals. And we've, you know, most people have gone through this. You really have to challenge the way that you think about something and step into that kind of uncomfortable zone. Is that fair? Is that something you agree with?
Yeah, I would, if I can give an analogy, and many years ago, one of our bosses, we were lucky enough, he had a ski chalet up at Mount Buller.
Oh, nice.
And I mean, I think I'm a decent skier, but I wouldn't say I'm an advanced skier. And this is going back many years ago. And he was a very, very good skier. And he said, let me take you up to the most challenging run in Mount Buller, Black Run, and looking up at that and going, my God, you know, how are you ever going to do it? But he pushed me and he pushed others in the group out of our comfort zone, and also gave us a sense of that self-belief that you can do it. Now, a couple of people did opt out, and I remember standing at the top of that slope and going, wow, how am I going to do this? Well, we ended up skiing that all afternoon. I lost count how many times we did that run. The only thing I kicked myself was that I could never complete it without falling once. But the fact is that I did it. Had he not been there to push me, I would never have challenged myself. And I think that's something that I've always reflected on in my career, is pushing myself out of my comfort zone, but equally doing likewise after being inspired by this guy, John Spark was his name, to help push people, because that's how you develop. Mm. And, yeah, if I'd never rolled the dice and gone to England, if once I got into Arthur Andersen, I'd never again push myself, and I had to push myself hard to lift my standards up to the benchmark and recalibrate what I want, I would never be the professional I am today. So a lot to take away from that experience there in London with Arthur Andersen.
I think one of the things when I look at, you know, your kind of LinkedIn profile, and obviously, Matt, I've been very fortunate to work with you, and you know, we've shared stories. I think one of the things that listeners will be fascinated by is this idea of working in different cities around the world. I think for a lot of people, it's an aspiration. And I always say, if you get the opportunity to work somewhere else in the world, you definitely should. So, you know, kind of give me or give listeners that sense of, you know, kind of what it was like. What was it like to work in Scandinavia, and you worked in Denmark? Was that for Royal and Sun Alliance?
It was. And actually, I was at a point where the family had come back to Australia after 5 years. Mm-hmm. I'd agreed to stay on. I stayed on by myself for a year. And really, that was to see a turnaround of my business unit through, and then with an acceptance that I'd be redundant at the end of it. Well, as I was about to head back to Australia, and the irony of the timing won't be lost on the listeners, that it was near the end of 2019, so immediately pre-COVID.
Yeah.
And my role was coming to an end in London, as we planned, and was about to literally step on the plane. And I had a call from a former board member of our European business that I sat on the board with. He had been appointed CEO of RSA's Scandinavian business that had a footprint in Norway, Sweden and Denmark, and said, I need some help, and would you like to come out here for 6 months and I'll make it worth your while? And I had a chat to my wife, and because he had made it worth my while, definitely, I took up the opportunity. It was at the time I said was only going to be 6 months. Well, sure enough, I came back to Australia to spend time with the family for Christmas before heading out to Scandinavia. And lo and behold, I was only there for 2.5 months and COVID hit. And again, I go back to this creating your own luck. And had I not taken that opportunity, it would have been a very dire circumstance for me at my point in my career with seniority, and trying to get a job during COVID would have been virtually impossible. And what made it even better at the time was when everything was closing in Copenhagen, and my boss gave me a call. He called me on the Sunday and he said, you better get back to your family in Australia because everything's going to shut down here. And I was literally on a plane within 24 hours and actually caught the last Emirates flight out with all of the crew in this world to get out. And so I was lucky enough. I spent 4 months working in Australia, basically on European time. And ended up going back there and actually spent another nearly 18 months over there. But in terms of culture, it was interesting that when I was working in England, there was always this perception of the Scandinavians as being very much into their lifestyle more so than work. And so that was my perception going in there, that they didn't really work that hard. And it was interesting going over there that I was able to bust that myth. And they do work hard, but equally they also like to manage their own time. And I think it's something that societies now, and I think English societies and Australian societies and probably American, have more learnt post the pandemic to find more of a balance. And what I found with the Scandinavians, they came to work very early, but then they would go and have lunch at about 11 o'clock, maybe 11:30. And it's something that we're not really that used to. And it's something that they all go as a collective. It's quite normal there for employers to provide lunch facilities there for which you pay, but they have hot meal and obviously the Danish open sandwiches and the like. Mm. But it's very much a social thing that they go, very different to what you see for the most part here in Australia and England. So it was really nice in that regard. They also tended to leave relatively early, but that was for family commitments. But you would find that they would be back online. So it was great to experience what they're like. It's a very difficult society to make inroads into and make friends, and they are very much family first. And close circle of friends are very close second, and they don't let outsiders really into that. It takes a long time to penetrate Scandinavian social circles. That's not to say they're unfriendly. They're very friendly people. I really enjoyed my time. Copenhagen is a wonderful place, as is most Scandinavian countries, and it's great to experience, again, working with different nationalities who have very different cultures, and again, what you can actually learn from them. And again, I feel I walked away from my experiences there. Again, I think I'd describe now, Colin, as a more rounded professional. I think these experiences just keep rounding you in different ways. Language is another one. Now, whilst the Danes, their English is excellent, and as one remarked to me, given that we're only a country of 5.5 million people, if we didn't learn English, we'd be in real trouble because Danish is pretty hard to learn. Mm-hmm. It also taught you about how you have to adjust your tonality and language and really slow down and think about that you're speaking with an audience who, whilst their English is very good, it's still their second language, and an Australian language is very different to an American because they have learnt more in American, particularly from television and the like. So it's, again, useful when you're here and in Australia, that is, and you're dealing with people who, again, English is their not their native tongue, helping them think about how they talk and present and just helping them learn to adapt such that they come across a lot better than they may otherwise do.
Yeah, this is the really fascinating point, Matt, and you're absolutely right. I think that the more experience we can get of other people's social cultures, we become more rounded because we better understand, we can have greater empathy for different people from different nationalities, different countries. It's something I wrote about in a white paper recently. I talk about this real, certainly for executives, that, you know, what they've got to do is really understand the importance of social culture, so different people from different cultures and how that plays into workplace culture. One of the other things that I talked about was the importance of committing to culture, which is something that I still think is a relatively new concept for lots of senior executives. But you're an example, and you're an example in finance as well, as CFO. You know, a lot of people will say, oh, you know, finance directors and CFOs, they always question, well, where's the value for money? Where's the value for money? But talking to you, you've always seen the importance of that commitment to culture, certainly in the work that we've done. You know, as I say, I've been fortunate to work with you over the last couple of years, but before that as well, right? This was something that you've always seen a value in.
I think it's something, Colin, to be fair, you've helped me with it, but equally, I think the best example I go back to is when I was at RSA. My first role there was about transforming finance. Never an easy job to undertake. And it was part of a broader program across RSA. And just for listeners, just to give a bit of historic context here, RSA had a near-death experience in 2013 as a consequence of a quite major fraud in its Irish operation. It parachuted in a new CEO in 14, in Stephen Hester, the ex-head of British Land and RBS, a very no-nonsense CEO. Difficult mandate, three-point strategy that he set out. One of those mandates was about right-sizing the business from a cost perspective. So for the UK, we had a significant cost reduction target, and I was part of that project to transform finance, but make no mistake, that meant reducing cost, and it was reducing cost by about 30%. And in kicking that off, I kicked it off in a very traditional sense, and very much, I think, as you said, Colin, you know, what's the benefit out of this? And really looking at it through the cold, hard, calculating eyes of a finance professional. And to be honest, it was probably about 12 months into that journey. And a journey, mind you, I'd been warned by one of the consulting firms who had been around a long time. They said, just to let you know, this is the 14th time RSA is trying to transform finance.
Wow.
So good luck with that. that probably made me even more determined. But it was probably about three quarters of the way through the first year, maybe 12 months, and sort of the penny dropped, and it wasn't as though it was just me. Other people were saying that, okay, so what are we trying to actually do here? And reflecting on that for a long time, that whilst we had the ambition that you didn't really want to share with people as to what you wanted to really be doing, whilst cost was one thing, you needed to modernise the function, and that is thinking about it through a people, process and technology. Cost to me is an outcome, and that's where the program really pivoted, and we thought differently about what we were trying to do and how we were then selling it. And whilst not everybody would be a part of the ultimate journey, those that were, we needed to ensure that they bought a ticket to be on the train and wanted to come with us on that journey. And we came up with this concept of a three-year vision on a page, and we sort of had the sun as our ambition, keeping in line with our corporate logo, and just tried to paint a picture for people to say there's a better future here, and for those of you that stay with us, it's going to be a better place. And look, Colin, I'm not going to sit here and say that if I had all of my colleagues from finance here at the time, they'd say, oh, it's a wonderful journey, wonderful place, because that's never reality. But boy, did we transform finance? Yes, we absolutely did. And particularly through digital technology, digitizing what we did, that function shifted the needle materially. And in fact, I bought a woman by the name of Jane Poole. Jane is a very senior finance executive now at Aviva, but she was really pivotal for me in what we achieved and getting people on the journey. Equally, we bought in PwC, bit of a plug here for PwC, they need a bit at the moment, but with their perform methodology. Now, look, it's a lean methodology, but the finance guys who were based out in Liverpool, we were mainly based in Liverpool, our finance business partnering more in London. So the core of finance and our centre of gravity was there. And we invested in them to teach them new ways of doing things. Well, that implementation there, I think, is still rated by PwC as their best implementation of their perform methodology. We did a great video at the end of it. And in fact, because I'm still a non-executive board member on the European board, I still get to go back there. And to this day, they still have their daily stand-ups, their whiteboards all around. And so culturally, it really is a great feel. It also helped that we modernised the office in Liverpool, turned it from this horrendous 70s, god-awful, very dated, to a very modern fit-out. But that combined with modern business techniques and digitisation made it a really, really great place. And ultimately, the pinnacle for us was in 2019 being awarded British Accountancy Finance Team of the Year, which is a pretty significant award and really was a reflection of the five-year journey that we've been on. It was 5 years to get to that point. So, it was a really great story.
Yeah, and I think that the winning of the award is really a demonstration of the work that everybody put in. You know, I always say when you win an award for your culture, there's no one person that deserves the award. Everybody does. And as we know, Matt, when we talk about transformation, and you know, you talk about digitization, right? In order to get the value from digitization, it requires behavior change. So when we talk about transforming, we're talking about transforming the way we think, the way we act, the way we behave, the way we collaborate with each other. And as you said, it's the little things like changing the way the office is. And by the way, and I don't know, I think I might have talked to you about this before, but I've worked in that building, but where I used to work for the Liverpool Echo, which was below the Royal Sun Alliance.
It's
a dreadful 70s building. Like it's the worst kind of brutalist architecture you've ever seen. So I know exactly what you're talking about. But that award is a real, it's a celebration of culture and human endeavor, right?
Yeah. And I use my analogy that I always have an open mind with everybody. And what you're trying to share with them is a vision for a better place. And I talk about leading horses to water, just using that old saying. And you find that the majority of people will go and they want to drink. But you still have the people who still refuse. And in fact, again, this is where you see bad culture, where people may see a better way, but they just don't want to be a part of it. And, you know, we had an instance there in Liverpool with we did a review in our FinOps, and it showed a 92% first-time error rate, which came through from effectively the front office from insurance operations to finance operations. And it was like, this is a wonderful opportunity to improve this and make the whole process for ultimately customers better, but equally for our people better, that they don't want to be sitting there, oh, it's wrong again, send it back, wrong again, send it back. But their manager just didn't want to engage in this at all. And he just saw it through the cost cutting and basically bought into it whilst we were there and whilst the consultant was there, gave us the savings, which was purely vacancies. And as soon as we walked out the door, reverted to old practices.
Mm.
And there was a saying that one of our partners in Arthur Anderson in London said, that it's about management. And when you talk about a lot of problems, he says with companies, he said there's three problems: management, management, management. And this was a great example where it was management, and the only thing you could do is change management. And that's what we did. And guess what? Amazing change, and we were able to put in place what was needed for that function to turn it around. So that's where a lot of people will come on the journey, but there are always going to be those people who unfortunately will just be that change resistant and not willing to, I think, as you said, adapt and the like. And there are times when you have to make the hard decisions to enable an organisation to move forward and for you to be able to build the culture that that organisation needs to be successful.
You know what, Matt? It's so true, and it's so rarely talked about, is that you 100% right. I couldn't agree with you more, is that every now and again, and it doesn't happen very often, but there are certain people who want to do their own thing, which is completely obtuse to the culture that you need in order to grow and perform and achieve your goal, all of these kind of things. And you can't afford to walk past that behavior or that performance. You have to help them, empathy out, first of all. Let me understand, why do you feel this way? How can we help? But ultimately, if they don't want to get on the bus leaves without them, and they find a different bus to travel on. I've got one more question for you, Matt.
Sure.
Taking up way too much of your afternoon. So culture evolves all of the time, as someone who's worked in different countries, different continents. So what are the things that you do to stay abreast of what's relevant now in the world of work? And, you know, especially post-COVID, is that things have changed so much. So where do you get your insights from, you know, kind of when you think about how you want to grow, develop yourself, as well as the cultures that, that you preside over?
It's a very good question, and it's something that I just do more instinctively. And I think first and foremost is, and let's accept, I mean, viewers can't see me here, but I'm no spring chicken, that's for sure. And so you've seen in your career how workplace cultures evolve. And if I think how culture was when I started to where it was today, it is completely different. And as you'd appreciate, and probably those days at the Echo in Liverpool, I'm sure I could name a couple of pubs that, you know, at this time on a Friday afternoon, you would have been down there probably three pints in at this stage.
Definitely. At least three.
And the world has moved on from there. And I think that's the key thing for me is how you are attuned to workplace culture that is applicable at the time, but equally the place. So we talked about working overseas and understanding different cultures, and you just have to observe and understand and attune and adapt to that culture. So I think that's something that I'm always aware of and thinking about, that, hey, what we did 20 years ago is probably not what we do today. And that's not to say you can't do things. It's just about doing things differently and thinking about things differently. Not to say I'm perfect by any stretch of the imagination. I'm sure my team would say, you know, well, you're still doing things the old way. I don't like to think that I do too much, but I'm sure I do. Otherwise, what I'm very much into is about network. And so it is more, and I benefit from that as well. So if I give a couple of examples where more recently I've selected my directs, and I've got six directs in finance at Australian Super, and I asked them to bring one of their high potential talents along, and we were able to have a one-on-one with Ryan Stokes, who's CEO of Seven Network. Now, how did I get onto Ryan Stokes? One, it's pretty handy because Australian Super, as a large investor, has access to a lot of these people. But it was through a CFO program that I'd done with Deloitte. I'm giving a lot of plugs here. And we had had a presentation there then from their head of tax for the Seven Group, a guy by the name of Richard Richards, who is unquestionably one of Australia's leading CFOs, and an amazing career story as well. And I was having a drink with him after the event, and I said, look, would you mind coming along and presenting to my tax team that started out at? And it ended up, he said, look, we're going to be in Sydney. I've got Ryan there. Would you like to have Ryan? And it was wonderful. And to be able to provide that opportunity for my team to have one-on-one with a guy of the caliber of both Ryan and Richard was great. Equally, I've done it through a guy by the name of Sir Rod Eddington, one of Australia's preeminent CEOs, former CEO of Air New Zealand, ANZ, and British Airways is what he was best known for, and ultimately his decision to ground Concorde. He's been a mentor of mine for a long time. And again, I was able to bring him to my entire finance team and get them to share. And I think that that sort of cultural sharing and hearing from those CEOs is wonderful because people just don't get the opportunities. Recently, what I've done is to, through a connection I have with IFM, their CFO, I work with at ANZ, and I said, look, our finance business partnering team, we're learning and we're trying to develop and trying to get better and be working on, towards our ambition of upper quartile. And you guys are asset managers, you manage a lot, you know, I think we could learn a lot from each other. So we set up a round the boardroom table. We had 10 of them, 10 of us. We discuss things, share things. You show me yours, I'll show you mine. And then we went to the pub after. And what was really pleasing there, and their CFO said to me after, I was really worried that they were going to go there and just go into their own corners. But what they did, they fragmented pretty quickly into about four small groups and really started chatting amongst each other. And that to me is what I feel that I can do is facilitate like that to help people learn off one another. And I did it also, you mentioned at GE. Well, when I was at GE, I just reached out to the other four large US fincos here in Australia, you know, like AMEX, Goldies, Citi, JP Morgan, and we just set up a finance director's little network, and that was great, just to be able to chew the fat over things and regulatory issues or accounting changes or the like. And that's what I sort of tend to do myself, is through that networking. I've done it now in the superannuation industry with the four big funds, Aussie, Art, Aware and UniSuper. And again, we just get together informally to talk about things, and I find that's the best way to help stay relevant. But equally then, what I encourage my team to do is that networking. And networking, it's, I always remember when I was in my 20s and, you know, this networking thing, what's it all about? Never really got it. But in England, they said, you are the most networked Aussie we know in England, which is always nice. And I never think of myself that way, but I do make a big effort to get to know a lot of people. And I think it's really beneficial where if anybody says, oh, you know, I want to do something and I can connect somebody, and I'm not afraid to pick up a phone and ask anybody anything. And the worst they'll say is no, but I find whenever you ask anybody and they want to talk about themselves, they're always very happy to do so. So hopefully that answers your question, maybe in a bit of a roundabout way.
No, that's fantastic. And a great way to round it off, because not on what you've demonstrated there is not only your commitment to yourself and the fact that you're stretching your own thoughts, your own knowledge by networking with other people, you're also giving your team the opportunity to do likewise and then following it up with a little bit of social activity as well, all of which is crucially important to culture. Matt, it has been fabulous to have you on the show, and I want to say a huge thank you for sharing your knowledge and your stories with everybody today. Matt Harrington, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks so much for listening to the podcast. If you've enjoyed the show, please share the link with your colleagues and friends or with your connections on social media. If you'd like to find out more about the work that I do, head to www.colindellis.com or find me on LinkedIn.